Good morning, and I apologize for my stuffy nose. I came down with a cold here in Denver, and it's hard to take somebody seriously who sounds like this, I recognize. But anyway, I'm happy to be with you and to talk with you about an idea that has really kind of come to us through this work. So specifically, we're going to look at social injustice in a penal harm approach to healthcare, and share with you some women prisoners' account of provider-patient relationships, which we believe illustrate a penal harm approach. Diane and I have no relationships to disclose. Our work has been funded by the American Nurses Foundation and by the California Endowment. And so I'll just start with a little bit of an idea about how we're thinking about penal harm. There is a fairly significant literature out there on penal harm. Penal harm is the purposeful, state-sanctioned infliction of punishment on those who are incarcerated. It is evident in jail and prison health care when care is withheld or delayed. And it is often those cases that come to legal attention. Penal harm, we would suggest, is more complex than blaming physicians and nurses. And any of us who have practiced inside these systems know how complicated it is to deliver care inside that is respectful and comprehensive and puts the prisoner patient first and foremost and central. So I'm not here to bash physicians and nurses. However, I think we've got some issues. Some sources of penal harm that have been suggested in the literature and that I think we can see in our own work is that physicians and nurses can be mechanisms for deliberate harm. That correctional staff who undertake tasks that are intended for medical professionals are engaging in penal harm. Correctional facility policies in which officials override decisions made by medical personnel are engaging in penal harm. For example, when patients need to be taken out of the facility for medical scrutiny, x-rays, whatever kind of care needs, and because custody says we don't have the persons to provide security, they're not going. And last but not least is penal harm can occur when, as a consequence of decisions to use a managed care model, such as co-payments, for example, where cost-saving decisions compromise care. So our work in both studies that we've undertaken really has both examined women's prisoners' experience of health and what their own health needs are, and as well as their access to care in U.S. jails and prisons. I'm not going to focus much on methodology, but I'm completely happy to talk about it if you have concerns or questions about it. Fair to say we've tried to be true to the multiple dimensions of community-based participatory research, and former prisoners and current prisoners have guided our studies and have been intimately involved in our work. So the findings I'm going to share with you today are based on both of these studies and represent this work out of 16 focus groups that we conducted. Our participants were between the ages of 20 and 59 and had, as most women prisoners do, a variety of health issues that included mental illnesses, substance abuse, asthma, hypertension, diabetes, multiple musculoskeletal complaints, dental problems, sexually transmitted diseases, pregnancy, and other acute health concerns. They had also, and these data really represent their experience not only in the local jail system, but in prison where many of them had spent significant time. Out of our access data came these, what have been referred to in other research as problematic provider-patient relationships. And the women in our studies really identified these as a major impediment to their seeking health care, both inside the jail and prison, as well as back out in the community. There were four distortions in provider-patient relationships that we could see in our data. Not taking prisoner health care concerns seriously, failure to respond, mistreatment of prisoners with mental illness and substance abuse problems, and use of derogatory language to refer to prisoners. And what I want to do is just share with you some data about how we arrived at these categories to sort of substantiate these categories for you. Not taking prisoner health care concerns seriously. One of our prisoners said, "I really needed to see a psychiatrist. The first time I went, they told me to read a piece of paper." A second prisoner shared, "My wrist was swollen and it hurt bad. When they took the cuffs off, I told them. They said, 'You're fine, just shut up. You're going to be out of here in 12 hours. Now, the patient's wrist was fractured. Failure to respond. They wouldn't answer the emergency call bell, the prisoner told us. The girl was having a seizure, and they turned their emergency button off. It's for emergencies. Why don't they answer?" Another said, "When I got there, I told them I was a diabetic, but they wouldn't listen to me. Then I went into a coma." Mistreatment of prisoners with mental illness and substance abuse problems. "They leave girls with untreated serious mental illness in with the rest of us. When something tragic happens, they remove them." A second said, "I had girls in the cell who was kicking heroin. They were so sick, projectile vomiting, flying off the top bunk. They get so sick, no one comes. They don't want to deal with them. They don't care." Use of derogatory language to refer to prisoners. "The doctors and nurses would call me cow or dog. I know I'm a criminal. Why do they have to call me names?" A second said, "They laughed at me when I tried to tell them," health providers, "about my body and what was wrong." A third said, "They would tease her," a prisoner with mental illness. "It's not right for them to do that." So what we believe we are seeing, and penal harm gives us a little bit, from my point of view, of a conceptual leverage on some of these data. So we see penal harm in nursing, penal harm nursing, and medicine for that matter, illustrated in our findings of these everyday routinized practices that stand for standard acceptable nursing care. And these, in our estimation, represent serious injustice. These same similar distortions in provider-patient relationships have been identified in detention centers by the Human Rights Watch. These interactions promote distrust and avoidance of health providers inside and at reentry to the community. They reinforce well-established health disparities and they increase patient suffering. They also represent lost opportunities to improve the health status of women prisoners and the communities to which they return. What is needed? We call for a vision of prison health as human right and as support for social justice. We ask for implementation of national and international prison health care standards. We suggest that public administration support is needed for health care providers who challenge the status quo with inside jails and prisons, because right now they're fired when they call attention to these kinds of abuses. We also suggest that philosophical and administrative changes are needed in our approach to incarceration. We'd like to, we always take this opportunity to really thank the women who were willing to participate with us in our study, and we thank you for listening. Any questions, thoughts? Yes.
Sorry, I'm out of time, but
that's all right.
Can you discuss a little bit about IRB? Because we're trying to do similar studies.
You're having
hard time.
The IRB.
No, that's all right. Well, we didn't have too much trouble with our IRB, which probably is just luck of the Irish.
Also, in the second setting, we used former prisoners.
Yeah, you know what we've done, because we worry about retribution. And Diane didn't go into it so much today, but she went into it a little more yesterday. We have had some real challenges in presenting these data to the Sheriff's Department and other authorities. And so one of the things, because they wanted names and numbers of the women who participated, and we're like, yeah, right. What we've done is moved out and basically are working with people on reentry, not going inside as much, because we're really concerned about the retribution. And that helped us, I think, get through the IRB. We also had former prisoners working with us, which I think can be helpful. What kinds of troubles are you having? Because there's probably expertise in the room as well about IRB issues. Yeah. 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 Well, as with any person participating in research, we have disclaimers about risks and benefits, and we've always thought of prisoners as any person participating in research. They have the capacity for autonomy and for making decisions based on our honest appraisal of a study. And so I guess I would argue for the fact that any person in a clinical trial, if you think that ain't got hope connected to it, I used to do research in clinical trial work, I'm sorry, on ethics in clinical trials. It's no different in my estimation. Other people may have different.
And also, this serves to keep it hidden.
Yeah. We're about exposure. We're not about hiding. So there's some ethicists in the room.
If you allow me, there are two attached questions. One is looking at the incarcerated population as a community.
Yes.
It's very informative, as you've shown us. But I bet you that if you broke them down into cohorts, especially by age, sexual orientation, previous exposure to substance, you will find very important differences, as well as sexual, you will find very important differences within this cohort. The problem that we have encountered over the years with looking at communities, incarcerated communities, is that they are purported to come into the system with very poor health profiles.
Yes.
Which in people's minds is justified that many of them have significant health catastrophes while incarcerated. Like, what do you expect?
Sure.
That kind of nonsense.
Yeah.
And so the idea becomes, how can we follow these cohorts over time and classify them by health risk and understand the responsiveness or lack thereof of the health system to their health crisis?
Yeah. Well, we clearly need more longitudinal research, both inside and out. We know they die pretty fast when they get out. And it's interesting. We shouldn't be putting them in at this rate. We've got an idea about trying to do a piece of longitudinal research and follow them to see exactly what's going on. But it's
how accurate are their records, especially
terrible.
Yeah,
terrible.
Yeah. During incarceration, and what kind of chronic illnesses ensue, and how are they dealt with?
I know. And that's been a notorious problem in trying to do this research, is that their records are awful. The records that are kept inside on their health conditions are really inadequate.
But that in itself is something to report.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Because this really infringes on issues of human rights and good medical
care. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, data is extremely important, but we want to also parallel it with objective data that's in your face that says these people are suffering and you do a poor job.
Yes,
and
sure.
I think these two then really lead into the issue of advocacy.
Sure. I mean, we've got plenty of quantitative data that says we're doing a lousy job. And the data together, qualitative and quantitative, haven't nudged it much, I'll tell you. What's nudged it are the law cases. It's getting somebody right by the jugular, basically. And, I mean, that's a sad thing, but that's what's changed care inside prisons slightly, and it's what changed mental health care. And we've got a long way to go still with both of those areas. But I don't disagree. We need to work more compatibly together, I think. I think I'm... Okay, sorry. Yeah.
In the bigger context, this might be a small point, but I'm curious. Emphasize that in this, it's really two talks going together.
So yes, exactly.
In your talk, the rudeness of health professionals in prisons.
Yes.
And at least in, this is just anecdotal, my sense of hospital work where rudeness goes on, there are two kinds. One is the career rude people. But there are a lot of young professionals who find themselves in uncomfortable situations.
Yes.
And I'm hearing a lot of discomfort underneath that rudeness.
Yeah.
Are the health professionals who work in prisons mostly in careers working in prisons, or are they usually just people who
It's a beautiful question. I don't think we know much about the workforce inside. What little we know, and Diane and I are putting together a study to try to look at the contemporary health worker inside, nurses and physicians, and primarily nurses since they are the largest providers inside, but often educated outside the United States, from very different cultural backgrounds than the people who are incarcerated. And what little we do know about the workforce suggests that people with, and this isn't rocket science, but people with better educations in nursing, that is, who have both a community health and mental health backgrounds, tend to operate from the values of care, compassion, and comfort. And those that are less well-educated and probably have fewer tools in their toolbox, because these are not always easy folk to work with, tend to subjugate those care, compassion, comfort values to those of custody. And so we may have quite a bit of that going on. At least in the state of California, prisons and jails were a place where lots of people went to get a job who couldn't be employed elsewhere. And there's lots of pretty horrendous data about physicians working inside. In the state of California, when it went into receivership in 2006, I believe, one of the things that the first receiver did was increase the salaries of physicians and nurses exponentially. Those positions now have gotten filled, probably by a different crowd of folk, many of whom came out of the state mental institutions within the state of California, sort of draining those places. So the workforce issues are important, and I don't think we know enough about them, and we're going to try to find out something more about them. As soon as we do, we'll let you know. Thank you very much.